Good evening, this is Mae Brussel. The title of this broadcast is World Watchers. It's a one-hour analysis of news. I always recommend that you tape record these if you can. And many, many more of you are sending self-addressed stamped envelopes for bibliography sheets that are available with the sources of information of the broadcast. It's broadcast number 757. It's June the 9th, 1986. I'm not going at great length into the Rogers Commission report on the Challenger and the shuttle accident. I'm going to be doing more of that next week. I'm not going to talk about Kurt Waldheim and the presidency of Austria this evening. I'm going to put over for another few weeks the arrest of Franklin Camper and seven of his other mercenaries in San Bernardino, California, six others rather, and himself. And I have to delay the story of Jonathan J. Pollard, the Israeli spy, our Navy intelligence spy, who was working for Israel with Rafi Eitan. That is very important, and I'm diagramming and charting out various connections of that that I never had time to do and promised before, of the links of these people to Permandex, to the murder of John Kennedy, and how this case and these particular people slice the researchers of the John Kennedy assassination right down the middle and separate those who are willing to go that extra mile off the grassy knoll to the people behind the murder of John Kennedy, or those who hold the line and say, we'll never know. And then there's another big story that I have not done yet or mentioned. Ted Rubenstein, who's a fantastic researcher, called me this week. He said, you haven't talked about the lawsuit placed by two American freelance journalists filed in federal court May 29th, 1986. It's against 30 persons, part of the Contra operation, who have smuggled weapons and drugs and plan to assassinate another guerrilla leader, Mr. Eden Pastora. He survived a bombing attack in which eight people were actually killed in the bombing, and these two reporters were injured. Now, that eight is seven more than Ronald Reagan was referring to at the Berlin Disco. A second person died as a consequence of that bombing. But that was an excuse to bomb Libya. In this case, when it's his team and he's funded the Contras and they try to kill a leader that they don't want dividing the efforts of the projects between them, they tried to kill him and they killed eight other people and it was hushed up. Now, mentioned in this lawsuit, I'm not going to all 30 people, I'll do more, of course, later. One is Adolfo Calero. He's the one of the defendants in this suit. He's one of the Contra leaders and he managed the Coca-Cola plant for Somoza in Nicaragua. The other is retired Major General John Singlaub, probably one of the most important men in American history, turning events around in a distasteful way, similar to Mr. Willoughby, Charles Willoughby, after he entered the American intelligence system after leaving the Fry Corps, or rather the Kriegs Academy, not the Fry Corps, although he set up the Fry Corps in this country, Willoughby and Singlaub. The Kriegs Academy in Germany studying warfare under Adolf Hitler's generals and so forth. Singlaub and Willoughby are terribly important. Willoughby has long gone, but his legacy is here. Singlaub is mentioned in there. Tom Posey, head of the Alabama paramilitary group called Civilian Military Assistance. Theodore Shackley, the same Shackley that was in Rome with Francesco Pazienza just before the Pope was shot and was instrumental, along with Michael Ledeen and Claire Sterling and Paul Hensey, for turning the story of Aja around, the trial of a century. Remember that they couldn't prove the KGB links to the assassination attempt on the Pope. Major General Richard Secord is also a defendant in their former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense. And Thomas Kleins, another biggie, is named as a defendant. The Christic Institute is a group that is taking the lawsuit. An attorney by the name of Daniel Sheehan is representing the journalists. He represented the family of Karen Silkwood and also the Greensboro, North Carolina socialists and communists that were killed. The families, he represented them. Their members were killed by the Nazis and Klan. So this is just giving you a cast of characters. You know it's big. So I'm putting these stories aside because they really take a lot of connections of things I've done for you before and material you haven't yet seen. I put down a few of these efforts to call attention to the plight of humanity and the fact that they are overnight events and don't seem to really take hands on or concentrate on some of the major problems. But there's one group the Amnesty International that I've always supported psychologically in any way I could. And torture is a terrible thing, and they are raising money, as you know, for concerts around the country. They kicked off their event in San Francisco, and there was an article in the San Francisco Chronicle about how much good music there was and how much feeling there was, and that was the perfect place to begin this event up there, because the heart and soul of a particular kind of political awareness and music really evolved in the Bay Area. Very important scene for the message and the music. And in the San Francisco Chronicle, it cites the fact that people not only got their money's worth by going to the concert, but the person who wrote this, Joel Selvin, said they came out with something extra, an intangible sense of having come together to make life better somehow. That is a feeling that money can't buy. It was free for the taking to anyone at the concert. And I think that about explains why some researchers like myself and David Emery and John Judge and a whole slew of people who prefer to remain anonymous do the things we do, because in some way you feel, I don't know how, but even exposing those people who would otherwise be hiding under the rocks, you feel some way you can make life possibly a little better, that someone someday will catch on of who's doing the hurting and how it comes about that they get away with it. Now, just a couple of items about the shuttle report. There's a long article in the Sunday Chicago Tribune and also reprinted in the San Francisco Chronicle. Large headlines, one man turned the shuttle probe around. And it quotes one staff member by saying, no one here wanted to find out what we found out. And it's very significant that while they cited Alan McDonald, that was the engineer for Morton Thiokol, that they did call attention that it doesn't take very many people to even turn an event around like this, because the national attention and media admitted that they thought that they would do a good job of covering up. This was on the news media when the Rogers Commission started, that they would cover up. And because Alan McDonald did tell the public what happened and how about the danger of the ice and the cold on the O-ring, they were forced then to take other testimony, and it did make an important difference in the history of the shuttle program, in the history of science and the world, in the history of how commissions will cover up if they can, and how they allow seven people to go onto a ship knowing the probability of their dying was very, very real. As a matter of fact, the report came out and said there wasn't any reason for their death. Now, it wasn't just carelessness, and I've gone into the reasons why I believe it was a military operation, and I'll do more next week. I might say, well, giving credit to Mr. McDonald, Alan McDonald, Turner Broadcast covered that launching of the shuttle. They were the only one who was there. And by seeing the icicles and viewing that day, that broke the story open, literally. So there were three or four or five people responsible for turning this around, actually. Besides Alan McDonald, it was the visual fact of the icicles. As a matter of fact, that was mentioned on CNN this afternoon, that all you had to do is look at those icicles and know that it wasn't going to go. And this was said quite clearly, that the icicles and the launching against the advice of the bad weather caused the accident. Another hero, a major hero in this entire case, and I'll do more about him later, is Richard Feynman. He's a California physicist, a Nobel scientist. He has an amazing biography, and I understand that he has cancer. I don't know. Somebody told me that. I haven't read it, but somebody close to the White House had said that Feynman had cancer. Now, he had a scathing report of NASA, and he's the scientist who took a rubber O-ring similar to their large O-ring into the commission within 1 or 2 days and showed what happens when it's cold and how it reacts to the cold. And he was the one person who William Rogers wanted to throw out his report. He suggested dumping it, and Feynman then wouldn't have his name on the report. So they said, well, won't put in the report. We'll have yours separate from all the others. It'll be Appendix F. So Feynman at least gets an appendix, but he could not be interviewed. And when William Rogers had a press conference today to this shuttle program and the report regarding that, when somebody asked about Feynman, could he answer questions, Rogers just got livid and confused. And that's the one beautiful thing about having the videotape recorder, is that you can catch the face and the emotions of Rogers caught off guard, like, no, he can't come and speak. They're just me and nobody else. You know, he can't, one other person, but not Feynman. You can't talk to him. And his report can't come out till a month later. And Feynman is one of the heroes. And then the New York Times published reports about the icicles immediately and got the ball rolling on that and had information that the Rogers Commission had taken testimony about. It was perjury, that were lies, and it accepted it as fact. And somebody, one of the scientists there, and I'll go back to that again, who saw what he was doing, gave his information to the New York Times, and they published it, similar to something like the Pentagon Papers. And then stations like CBS, Dan Rather, were showing over and over again the ice on the shuttle and the solid rocket booster, so that there were some heroes, more than Mr. McDonald, but that's great. He should get the accolades, and I think Richard Feynman, they should get an award or some kind of a medal as the heroes of this whole story. One little tiny bit of not funny news. The Statue of Liberty celebration is coming up, and I'll do more on that later, but not a lot. It's so disgusting. But the New York Times, June the 1st, had a full-page information of how you buy your tickets and where you go, and where you get your admission to these various areas. And in pointing out the stars that would be there, they mentioned 1,000 tap dancers, 1,000 fiddlers, 1,000 voice choir, 500-member marching band. But the most obscene of all the things I've seen, and I every day I never get through being shocked, they're going to have 200 Elvis Presley sing-alikes. I mean, that is so horrendous. I can't imagine the next government assembly, when they have 200 John Lennons or 400 John Belushis or 200 Otis Reddings, or should we have 300 Janis Joplins or maybe 500 Marilyn Monroes or 200 Jimi Hendrix or 500 Jim Croce? You know, how do they ever come up with the idea of taking a person like Elvis Presley and having 200 people up there simulate Elvis Presley for a 4th of July celebration? It's really obscene. Now, ABC, as you know, Capital Cities, ABC won the exclusive rights for $10 million to put on the show of the Statue of Liberty. $7 million, and that's not very much, out of ABC stock, but Capital Cities was founded by William Casey, who has $7 million into this original company, Capital Cities, that merged with ABC. Our CIA director has probably the most prominent voice in anything that Capital Cities or ABC does from now on. And they can put a bid for $10 million, and the other broadcasts say, well, that's not fair. They rebut and say, well, we had the highest price. But Casey has a budget of $42 billion, so couldn't they put in out of those hundreds of millions of dollars under the guise of national security, because then we can guide what we see and who's on the telly and what you see. Couldn't it be possible that William Casey has unlimited money now, so that ABC can buy out anything it wants, so that ABC is having the what they want are the exclusive rights to something that belongs to the whole country or every station? How can you sell the celebration of the Statue of Liberty being refurbished to a single channel out of four major channels? The New York Times, June 2nd, has another story about the Statue of Liberty. It's titled, "It's Like Inviting Pinochet to July the 4th. This is written by Cynthia Brown. The Chilean ship Esmeralda, one of the most beautiful sailing vessels in the world, has been invited to participate at the New York Harbor July 4th in the large gathering of the tall ships. This ship was used by Chile for torture. The Esmeralda was used by the Navy as a floating torture center. She participated in the tall ship celebration in New York in 1976, representing the Chilean government at our bicentennial. Protesters met her on the docks. Journalists took notes of her horrifying past. Her participation coming back again in Liberty Week is profoundly disturbing." This lady writes, "It profoundly contradicts the spirit and the symbolism of Liberty Week. Normally a training vessel, the Esmeralda was converted into a prison September the 11th, 1973, the day that the Chilean military overthrew that country's last elected government. And that was arranged primarily by the Pentagon and Henry Kissinger and advising Richard Nixon and Kissinger and Task Force 157 and the government, Navy Intelligence, Pentagon, all agencies of our government were responsible for murdering Salvador Allende and putting in Mr. Pinochet, who's still doing the tortures and the missing persons. The article says, according to survivors, by the end of the day, the hold of the Esmeralda each day contained at least 40 men and 70 women. Prisoners of both sects were held naked in the same quarters. They were forced to listen to the screams of people tortured elsewhere in the ship. Amnesty International, the Organization of American States, Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, and others have published survivors' descriptions of what went on aboard the ship. That's one reason I'm always so loyal and keep the books that come out regularly from Amnesty International. They describe what went on. There were beatings, electric shocks, mock executions, sexual abuse of the women and of the prisoners. One former prisoner told Amnesty, "The fear, the screams, the crying of the ladies who were detained next to us cannot be expressed. The situation was of indescribable chaos. Everywhere there were lamentations. The man, a lawyer, was subjected to repeated near drownings, karate blows, electric shock on board the Esmeralda that has been invited to participate in the Liberty celebration in the United States. After they were tortured, they were then sent and transferred to concentration camps." Another survivor, the former mayor of Valparaiso, Chile's second largest city, has testified that he was blindfolded, beaten, given electric shocks, deprived of sleep. The Esmeralda was a symbol of Chilean national pride, of what one former prisoner called the chivalry of Chilean officers and sailors at one time. Then they turned the Esmeralda into a torture chamber. She is indelibly identified in the Chilean mind with terror and death. Nor is the same kind of torture that took place on the Esmeralda a thing of the past. She will come to New York representing that same regime that continues to torture, murder, and humiliate and terrify the citizens who oppose a dictatorship. In 1 3-week period just last month, that was in May of 1986, the Chilean military occupied 7 poor urban neighborhoods, rounded up 7,000 people, detained them for interrogation. And this article concludes on the symbolism of Liberty Weekend and how inviting this ship there when the Chilean government is still torturing is like having Pinochet and telling the powers that be what they think of freedom, and coming here to recognize and be part of the Reagan administration celebration. It's bonding of Ronald Reagan with Pinochet in more ways than one. Now, I mentioned last week the joining of hands across America, and at the time I didn't have access to a picture that was published in the Washington Times, May the 26th, 1986. It's a color picture. Hands across America, it's a front page picture of Ronald Reagan on the front door of the White House. President and Mrs. Reagan joined hands in fundraising effort. On the porch were left White House Press Secretary James Brady, then the various children they had with them, and Maureen Reagan and Nancy and Ronald. Now, the Hands Across America has a visual picture of 9 people on the porch of the White House, and 8 of them are holding hands. Then a little boy has his hands down at his side by his knee. And next to him is the wheelchair of James Brady, who had his head blown off, literally. I mean, he can hardly think or talk and barely manage, and he's permanently paralyzed and can't use that left arm. So the chain of Hands Across America breaks right at the White House porch, which is some more of the violence that gets away in this country with James Brady in this terrible condition. And John Hinckley was found not guilty of murder, attempted murder, or really damaging these people for life, several of them. But he is only put into a hospital for the criminally insane. Now, the Washington Post, the New York Times had an item about John Hinckley Jr., May 25th, the man who made Brady so crippled and paralyzed in that chair that the chain of Hands Across America ends right at that wheelchair. Hinckley objected, he wrote to New Republic, he objected to a comment by an unsigned letter criticizing Gore Vidal, who made some remarks, and she said that he was anti-Semitic and he was ready for the funny farm. Well, that made John Hinckley mad because he's at St. Elizabeth's, and he says using words like funny farm makes your mind twisted. He said, "You think that we're loony, because we're in this place. He said, Gore Vidal and myself, our opinions are just as valid as yours. And because we disagree with you does not mean we are crazy. We disagree with you, Gore Vidal, thinking he's anti-Semitic. Now, think about John Hinckley, or many of you might forget that he was part of the American Nazi Party in Illinois and in various parts around the country, a member of the Posse Comitatus in California, in Texas, part of the Nazi Party. He took a college course where he didn't have to but wanted to read all of Mein Kampf, a person who studied violence and target ranges, you know, practiced shooting, and has this virulent anti-Semitism. And he's defending the anti-Semitism or the possible anti-Semitism of Gore Vidal. And I'm not saying Vidal is, but this woman wanted to relegate Vidal to the funny farm. And that bothered John Hinckley because he has the same mind as Vidal possibly has. So he writes back and says, look, you may think we're crazy, but that doesn't mean we're crazy. So John Hinckley knew what he was doing when he shot Ronald Reagan, and he knew what he was doing when he shot Mr. Brady, or he worked with a team and there was a crossfire who shot Brady and the Secret Service agent and the policeman from Washington, D.C. But he defends his ideas, I'm not crazy, and he knew what he was doing, and he wrote a letter to the New Republic stating that I'm not crazy and I know my ideas, and taking the side, if Vidal is anti-Semitic, and we know he is, you don't relegate us to crazy, and that is a mistake. People think because Hitler served time in prison that he was crazy or something was wrong with him. Now, I want to mention the meeting of the OSS. This is very important. In Washington, D.C., this past week they had a reunion. It was described in various articles and also in Time magazine, June 9th, if you want to look that up, 1986. At the Hilton Hotel in Washington, the same place where Ronald Reagan was shot by John Hinckley, or a team including Hinckley, they had a reunion of the OSS, and of course, William Casey, the director of the CIA, the man who started Capital Cities that bought up ABC, was lauded as being an original OSSer, and behind Ronald Reagan, bigger than life, the size of a whole screen, is William Donovan, Wild Bill Donovan, the founder, helped found the CIA, but was head of the OSS, and this was a reunion of the OSS. And Ronald Reagan was the guest of honor. He was awarded an honor. And I wonder if when Ronald Reagan was in Hollywood simulating Peenemünde, which was the Nazi camp for Wernher von Braun and Walter Dornberger, who came to the United States to start the space program, when he was simulating the duplications of Peenemünde for Hollywood in 1940 when he was co-starring with Errol Flynn in 1942, I believe that the Gestapo tentacles rubbed off on Reagan over and over. Was he also in those days in the OSS? Because there were remarks made here about the secrecy and not knowing who the members were, and I wonder if he actually was one of the early people in the OSS. Time magazine cites honoring the loyalists, and they have James Angleton's picture. And, of course, the OSS and the CIA and Angleton go directly to Dealey Plaza to the murder of John Kennedy and the political assassination of hundreds and thousands of people that they deemed not to be heads of states or newspaper publishers or labor leaders and so forth. And the biggest part of their operation is their covert action. There were 600 people at the dinner, and one of them, Eileen Griffith, they described her, 63 years old, was recruited into the OSS while in college, and she was sent to Spain as a code clerk. She married a Spanish grandee to become the Countess of Romanones, festooned at this party now with diamonds and emeralds. She smiled and she reminisced to the people of the OSS, I hate to say it, but war is fun. And she turned out, of course, to have lots and lots of money. And along with James Angleton and William Casey, this article's about the reunion of various members and how Bill Donovan stacked the OSS, rigged the intelligence agency, they said, against President Roosevelt, who helped set it up, of course, by having elite socialites such as Paul Mellon, the millionaire, Archibald MacLeish, the journalist Stuart Alsop, performer Sterling Hayden, who just died last week. And at this party, this is Richard Helms, James Angleton, William Casey, and many of the survivors. I'm sure Vernon Walters was there, too. The survivors of the OSS who turned it then into the Central intelligence agency. Now, the problems that they developed are very much in the news today. It isn't a dead issue that the OSS died and these people are just getting together for a reunion, like a class reunion. The New York Times has an article, April 21st, Rebel aid, this is money to the Contras, said to strain Congress-CIA ties. And the article goes on to quote Vice Chairman Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont, who is investigating the Contra money. He said the new reliance on covert paramilitary action as a normal instrument of foreign policy, even as a substitute for foreign policy, has strained the current oversight process to the breaking point. He's talking in terms of what do you do to get foreign policy back to those people who are elected to make it and not into the hands of the covert actions. The article says, under existing procedures, the president has the authority to mount covert actions without congressional committees. The panels, which meet in secret session, must be notified of anticipated intelligence operations so they can raise objections. The administration can carry out covert actions without the committee's approval, but then it would run the risk of having financing cut off or restricted by Congress. Senator Leahy contended the administration is using covert procedures for matters that should be debated in public. It involves a most basic question which can only be resolved in open debate with the full awareness of the American people. The question is, can a democracy like the United States engage in large-scale so-called covert paramilitary operations using our intelligence agencies as instruments in waging proxy wars against the Soviet Union or its clients? And the war against the Soviet Union is the subject that I want to finish or do a half hour on this evening and continue from last week, such as the Chernobyl nuclear accident in the Soviet Union, which I believe was sabotage. And there are so many events of sabotage and Reichstag kind of operations where an event takes place and later we find out that it didn't happen that way, that it's very important to not get into the rush of things, which is exactly what our Congress does and follows the orders of the president. And for 5 years, we've been heading towards a total disaster. Another article by Robert Mary in the Wall Street Journal. This was June 2nd. Making foreign policy in elite secrecy isn't as reliable as trusting the people. This article says the struggle by William Casey, director of the CIA, to control news organizations over leaks calls to mind the ruminations of Louis Halle, H-A-L-L-E, a young State Department official in the early post-War II period. This is when the OSS all got their heads together, and the war was over in May of 1945, and in 1947, the CIA was official. Mr. Halle wrote a book called The Cold War as History. He argued that the government must keep the electorate in the dark on major foreign policy matters. International affairs concern intricate, sometimes arcane, balance of power realities. Because they are concepts the American people could never accept as justification for military action, voters must be fed other explanations, such as the world is being made safe for democracy or that the spread of evil communism is being checked. That's an elitist view based on the premise that foreign policy is best left to the so-called experts, and it seems to be the view of William Casey, who wants to prosecute newspaper people for telling the American people what the Soviets have already learned through various spies or through their own documents and so forth. Mr. Casey's approach was a secret war against the Sandinistas, the anti-Sandinistas with the Contras. Everyone knows today that covert actions don't stay covert. The issue was thrust into the public arena, so Mr. Reagan went to work to sell a reluctant public on the need to support the Contras, and he was forced to go public. That is the gist of that particular article. But the opinion of Mr. Donovan, whose face was bigger than life on a huge screen behind Ronald Reagan, and Reagan is grinning about it, the whole message of Donovan and the 400 or 500 corporations that worked with him and the major networks was that the public doesn't need to know and they wouldn't approve and they wouldn't like what we're doing, so we have to go ahead and do it on our own. in the newspaper that comes out weekly in these times, or semi-weekly, sent to me by a listener from World Watchers, there is a subject of the agent provocateur behavior at the Berlin Disco being set off as an excuse to bomb Libya and the dangers that happen when you rush to conclusions. This article, I'll just have a few minutes to finish this one paragraph of it and then continue on the second half of this broadcast. The article says it took a generation for the truth to emerge, compiled by Robert Scheer at the Los Angeles Times last year, that events leading to the Tonkin Gulf resolution, events that caused Lyndon Johnson to rush into the war, were manipulated and mangled by the Pentagon. I'll take a one-minute break now, and then we'll get back to this article on agent provocateurs and how they lead to military action, and the people at home pay with money and their lives, and they were lied to in the first place.